Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Today we examine the capitalist system and globalization with Bill Tabb, professor of economics and political science at Queens College and the Graduate Center of the City of New York. Professor Tabb is the author of The Amoral Elephant, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century.
Well, we wanted to start, how could we not, a title, The Amoral Elephant, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century. Bill Tabb, why the amoral elephant?
What you got against elephants?
Well, I have nothing against elephants, and I'm of mixed minds about naming it that way. It started with an interview that Joseph Heller did. You know, Joseph Heller, the novelist who wrote Catch-22, which is a wonderful book, and which you, those of you who read it may remember Milo Minderbinder, who sells parachutes to pilots who fly into battle without their parachutes because he sold them already for the silk. And he's a frightening, amoral, and of course really funny guy because Heller's a great writer. And in a 1998 interview, Heller talked about looking around the world and seeing his archetypal creation, the indefatigable, unprincipled entrepreneur everywhere. And quoting from Heller, he said, this close to quoting from Heller, like capitalism, he was amoral. He provided good things and bad things. He didn't think about consequences. He was antisocial and unpatriotic. In fact, he was a forerunner of the multinational corporation and the global economy. And so the amoral part of capitalism is this idea that Heller is capturing, and also that George Soros, you know, the billionaire hedge fund operator, who's also a social change philanthropist. And Soros was interviewed, and he said, I believe markets are amoral. And the point he was making was that as a capitalist, he's totally amoral, and that if he tried to be moral in his investment decisions, he would be an unsuccessful competitor. So he's got to be absolutely amoral. And as a human being, because he makes this distinction, he's a moral guy and he gives money to legalize marijuana and to help Eastern Europe become capitalist and things he thinks are good. But the point he was making is that the rules of the system, to the extent there are rules, are totally amoral. And they play havoc with people's lives in the wild swings of markets and capital flows and all the rest of it, which he understands very well because that's where he makes his money. That it's not a pendulum which swings gracefully back and forth. It's a wrecking ball that can suddenly come in and destroy a country, and that we're prisoners to these larger forces. So the amoral part's there. The elephant part is the old story. It's actually two stories. One is, you remember the five blind men and the elephant, and one of them grasps the trunk and thinks it's a tree. Another is pulling on the tail and thinks it's a rope. Another is holding a ear and thinks it's a leaf of a great tropical plant. That we look at capitalism, and each of us sees a different aspect of this overwhelming system. And, of course, it looks different for those who ride atop the elephant. They have a different experience of its nature than those who were trod beneath its feet. So the elephant itself is amoral. And so, thinking about a title, I said, hey, The Amoral Elephant. And since then, the bookstores put it in places with the Republican Party, you know, because they think that, you know, of course, the Republicans are amoral. It must be about that. Occasionally, it's being put in animal. It's just very odd. So it was probably a bad mistake to call it The Amoral Elephant. And so the subtitle, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century, is there to sort of help people understand what it's really about.
Well, let me take off on, again, the subtitle now and talk about capitalism, but not in the 21st century. Mark Weisbrot did an article from the Center of Economic and Policy Research on economic growth in the Third World and basically says that for the last 20 years, growth has been much, much less than in the prior 20 years from 1960 to 80 versus 80 to 2000. The question is, why has that changed?
Okay, it actually, it's 1973 is the usual breaking point. that the post-war period from the end of World War II up to 1973, there was very rapid growth in the United States, but also everywhere else, or many other countries, and living standards were rising. As globalization kicked in, growth rates slowed down, which made people very suspicious that if globalization was supposed to be helping everybody, what was going on here? Because inflation was going up faster than real standards of living, so that in this country, real wages, and people should understand when an economist says real wages, what they mean is your money wages, how many dollars you get, corrected for how much prices go up, so that if there's 5% inflation in a year and you get a 3% raise, you're actually worse off. You're 2% worse off because prices have gone up faster than your income. So if people follow their money wages, they're suffering from what economists call money illusion. You know, you go to the movies and it's $1.25 to go to the movies. Well, hey, now what is it, $9.50? So if you figure out what your expenses are versus what they were 20 years ago, most Americans are worse off, even though they've had increases in money wages. The purchasing power, what it costs to go to the doctor, what it costs to buy medicine, what it costs to buy food or pay rent, especially for us folks who live in New York, have gone up, and for most of us, our incomes have not. So the point he's making is true both for the United States, but also around the world, that inequalities, the difference between the rich and poor, in almost every country in the world have gotten far, far worse in these last 20, 30 years, more like 30 years now. So that's the sort of what the numbers look like. Why is much harder, because people can point to different explanations of that. The people who think it's globalization point to the fact that workers everywhere are now competing against each other in ways they didn't before. Before, there were national markets, goods didn't travel as far or as many, but with innovations in transportation and communication, a company like General Electric can tell its suppliers to move to Mexico and to set up factories in Asia and move their plant and equipment wherever they want, where they can get lower wages, and forcing concessions on workers here or in other places. And even the workers in Mexico have got to worry about Thailand or China, because with the lower cost of shipping goods and the ease with which blueprints and orders can go over the internet and through fax and all the other FedEx kind of communication, you have a globalized labor market which pits everybody in the world against everybody else, with a smaller number of very large corporations. And so that while there's competition among these corporations, the difference between their power and the power of workers has increased so much that they're able to apply these pressures everywhere. And I think that in broad outline is what we're seeing.
Bill, isn't globalization by any other name still imperialism and the old colonial policies really that dumped our products on their markets, inhibited the ability of the smaller nations and island nations to export? Is there really any substantive change between the imperialism that we railed against during the period of decolonization in the African nations and what we see today?
Well, you're at a different stage of development that, you know, the White House staff has been trying to get George W. to read the new biography of Theodore Roosevelt, and they're trying to pump him up as the new Theodore Roosevelt, and W's been carrying around the book. I don't know that he actually reads it, but if you think about the difference between a Theodore Roosevelt who carried a big stick and didn't exactly speak quietly about it, what he would do is he would send in the Marines if a country was not paying the bankers back their money. And the very famous quote from Smedley Butler, who was the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, who when asked about this, said that he was the muscle for Wall Street. He was the collection agent for the banks. And what the Marines would do is they would literally go in, set up in the harbor. The accountants would collect money on everything going in and out of the country. The Marines would pacify anybody who objected to this. And then when the banks got their money, their interest on their interest, whether it took a year or 5 years, they'd put somebody in power to sort of watch the store, and then they'd go off to the next country. So the militarism of that period and the collection was fairly straightforward in terms of, you know, how we treated countries we called banana republics. It's a odd sort of thing that we have these stores now called Banana Republic with people having no idea what this is an insult to the countries that had gotten their independence, but which were not really independent because the U.S. Embassy controlled who was president of the company, what their policies were, and so on. So you had this very stark kind of open imperialism. And imperialism back then was not a bad word. It was used to describe the system, which everybody understood, and which the United States thought was the natural order of the world, the way, 50 years before that, they had thought slavery was perfectly natural, and 100 years before that, they thought the divine right of kings was natural. So today, what they think is natural is that agencies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization should set up rules which force countries to do the work that the Marines used to do. That is, the countries are told, if you don't pay the debt, if you don't stop subsidizing food and buses for working people in your cities, and you need to send that money to the banks and so on, if you don't do that, we'll turn the oil tankers in mid-ocean, and your cars will stop, your factories will stop, and you'll starve to death, because we've increased the division of labor to make countries dependent on trade, that they must export, they must import. And if we can stop that, which of course we can, that's as good as the Marines. Now, of course, there are countries that resist that, and we send the Marines in or smart bombs or whatever to deal with them. But in the current period, what is different is not that the system is different, but the mechanisms used to control other countries, other economies, other peoples around the world have been in some sense modernized in these ways.
Now let's bring this to the present, and of course this isn't in your book, but you might want to relate it to something that's in the book, Argentina.
Yes.
Case, perhaps these mechanisms might be breaking down in terms of the refusal of the Argentinians to repay the debt?
Yes, Argentina is a country well worth watching, that it's had problems for at least a century, in that the elite of Argentina has been in control, and it's been in control in a really stupid kind of way, where the Argentina at the beginning of the 20th century, about 100 years ago, was one of the richest countries in the world. It compared itself to the European countries, and in terms of standard of living, it was at that level. And it's gone down in terms of its standard of living as a small elite has basically stolen everything and gotten it in trouble. The political complexion of the country, there has been a strong left, which, in order to pacify the workers' movements and the progressive forces in the country, the government has spent money, has the provincial governments have spent money, which they don't have, because the rich don't pay taxes. And in so many countries around the world where the rich don't pay taxes, what the government does is it basically runs the printing press. And by printing up lots of money, pays its bills and pays for minimal education, health, to prevent revolutionary situations from developing. And in doing this, you get inflation, because if you produce more and more money, but there's the same amount of goods and services available, prices start going up. So Argentina had like 5,000% inflation a year. Now, I don't know if you can picture 5,000% inflation a year. It's where prices are changed two or three times a day, and that you can go to the movies one day, and if you go the next day, it costs you more, and the day after that, it costs you more prices. So what they did was they linked to the dollar, and they tied their currency to the U.S. dollar. This is something that a lot of countries are beginning to do. Ecuador has already done it, but Ecuador went further. They actually abolished the sucre, and they just use dollars. You know, that's the currency of the country. It's the official currency. In many parts of the world, the dollar is the unofficial currency because the economic situation is so bad, nobody trusts their local currency. But what happened in Argentina is, in tying the value of their currency to the dollar, when Brazil, its very large neighbor, devalued the value of its currency, it made Argentine goods much more expensive. So people started buying next door in Brazil. And Argentina could not earn enough to get enough dollars to keep the convertibility going, and the convertibility collapsed. Now, they kept it going longer than they should have, which is an interesting thing. It wasn't working. Why did they do that? They did it, and they got loans, very large loans, from the International Monetary Fund. This money is used so the rich can take the local currency, change it into dollars, using all of those dollars that the IMF lends them. Then the currency collapses, and the people who get hurt are the ordinary people who just don't have the dollars. They have the local currency, which is now worth 40-50% less than it was before. But they're unable to get their money out of the bank. And as people who've been following the situation know, it's not just the poor and the working class. The middle class suddenly now is as poor as everybody else in terms of access to money because their money is worth less. They can't get their money out of the bank and so on. So it is a very extreme situation, but not... While it's extreme, it's not unlike what's happening in countries around the world because, and this is a lot, I know, for listeners to take in sort of one gulp, but we've had now, through this period of globalization, 20, 30 years, the same thing happening over and over and over again. That is, the International Monetary Fund, which is to say basically the United States Treasury Department and the banks on Wall Street and the financial institutions, force a country to open their economy and to allow in foreign investors. Money pours into the country. The price of assets, land, real estate, stocks go up. So it looks like this is great. But the speculation gets so huge that eventually it collapses. Often it doesn't take very long. The IMF lends the money to get them supposedly over the crisis. The rich people get their cash out in the form of dollars so they don't lose anything. The investors and the banks in America get repaid. And then the country is saddled with these huge debts. This happened in the Latin American debt crisis in the 1980s, beginning in Mexico, but spreading really all over the place. It happened in Russia. It happened in the late 90s in East Asia. The East Asians were last in line because they had refused to liberalize. But by the late 90s, the United States was able to force Korea, force Thailand, these other countries, to open their financial markets, and that led to the crises they had. The value of assets dropped, companies had to sell, everyone was panicked, and the American companies are there to buy at bargain basement prices, as we will do in Argentina, as we will do everywhere else, so that the U.S. Financial corporations, the banks, the transnationals, get to control what were once, if not independent economies, at least economies where there were nationalist policies and efforts to develop the country on their own terms but without being controlled totally by the outside. And so the pattern we're seeing is this kind of pattern, and Argentina is just the current manifestation.
Bill, the former Prime Minister of Jamaica, Michael Manley, described the development options of Jamaica, for example, as the two-noose theory, specifically the strangulation by the World Bank policies and the International Monetary Fund, that these nations, developing nations, were constantly caught in this dilemma of policies that rob nations of their self-sufficiency, their ability to become self-determining. But what kind of models, how do you shift the paradigm from these international elite organizations or U.S. capital hegemony and begin to develop an infrastructure with different investment policies that truly allow for them to become self-sustaining?
Well, I think the responsibility, Mimi, is on people in the United States and the other advanced countries. And the reason the demonstration at the World Economic Forum over these last couple of days was so important, and the other manifestations of opposition to this forcing, where the elite of the world forces the developing countries, the peoples of the world, to adopt their model. The pressure is very important because Americans basically think we're good people and we give foreign aid and we want to help everybody and all this. And it's very difficult for a country like Jamaica, after all a very small country in the world, to follow policies that the United States doesn't like. Because what the United States can do to a country is just brand it a terrorist, or it could say Americans can't travel there, or it could start a media offensive against communism or socialist influences, as it did with Manley. When all Manley did when he was prime minister is he tried to tax bauxite, which is what aluminum is made out of, and said, we want a fair price for our products. And basically, he was overthrown and forced out through thugs and American money to elect somebody who we were more, who was more friendly to what we wanted. And that for a government to try and resist the United States means it has to resist the destabilization that the United States is capable of doing, or sending troops into Grenada, or having a coup in Chile. You know, we've seen this over and over again. So it's very hard, just in terms of survival, for a country that wants to do something different to do it, given the force, not just of the IMF, but of the military power of the United States. So that to make it possible for people around the world to choose what they want to do with their economy, how they want their resources to be utilized, and also so that they can negotiate the terms on which foreign companies can do business in their country. You know, after all, if someone came into your house and said, well, I'm going to start using your kitchen and this and that, and you just get out of my way, this is basically what people in other countries feel we're doing. And so it's incumbent upon Americans to sort of understand what's going on and say that we as Americans don't want our country to do this, and that these corporations and their bottom line is not the same as our sense of human values and how we want our country to operate. So it's very hard for a country now to be independent of what the United States wants. During the Cold War, when there was a Soviet Union, and no matter what you think about the Soviet Union and its problems and where it did bad things or whatever, it enabled countries to follow independent policies, because if the Soviets were willing to say, we, if you beat up on this little country, you have to deal with us and we have nuclear weapons, it gave small countries in Asia or Africa or Latin America a chance to do something differently. Now, with one superpower and with the use and willingness to brand anybody a terrorist for whatever reason we happen to think that they're threatening us as opposed to us threatening everybody else, it's harder for countries to do this. And I just think that's a reality. And until American foreign policy changes to allow countries to basically make their own choices, it's going to be very hard.
What kind of forces would be necessary to do that? I mean, we have seen the development of a very broad, better use of a better word, I'd say student movement, perhaps youth movement, and of course the AFL-CIO to some extent mouths the same vocabulary but doesn't really go out on the streets at the same time. How do you see the development of the movement to do that?
Well, I think up to September 11th, the movement was doing exceedingly well. At the time of Seattle, there were, there are polls taken on public opinion on just about everything. And at the time of Seattle, when the media was blaming the protesters and the police were beating people up, a majority of Americans agreed with the protesters on all the indices about allowing other countries to develop, on protecting jobs, on giving foreign aid, you know, all the kind of questions that Americans, when you just ask them, have a very anti-imperialist, pro-working class point of view. It's astounding. And you can go in my book, The Amoral Elephant, I quote some of the polls in detail, saying what the cross section of Americans who are interviewed say. And then, of course, when you interview, they also do, Business Week does interviews of the corporate elite, and of course they say something totally different. But most Americans are very decent on these issues. but they don't spend a lot of time studying them. The students have a bit more time to think about it. It's when you're a student, it's this time before you're sort of locked into family and jobs and having bills you can't pay and all the rest of it, although I must say many students have those problems and those concerns, but you're able to sort of question. Increasingly, other Americans are questioning. Then September 11th happened, and what President Bush has done is he has, in effect, terrorized Americans into thinking that more attacks are imminent, that their lives are in danger, they shouldn't open their mail because of anthrax, and at this total full-court press that we have to increase our military budget, we have to have missile defense, we have to cut social spending, we have to spend less on our needs because we have to build up the military. And anybody who doesn't like it, anybody who, as Ari Fleischer said, doesn't watch what they say, is supporting terrorism. So the country is in a sort of a difficult position where people have to separate out, what do you think about Enron, where this seventh largest corporation in America, run by George Bush's best friend, Kenny Boy, he and George were, this was the man that was George Bush's best friend, who gave, basically built his career, gave him all the money, told him who to appoint, told him what kind of regulatory policies to follow, wrote the energy policy that Cheney won't let anybody know about, that the job losses we're getting, our pension losses, all of these terrible things that are happening to ordinary working Americans, the president says, well, don't worry about those, worry about the terrorists. Throughout history, whenever elected officials get into trouble, or whenever rulers get into trouble with the masses, they start a war. Because when there's a war, and Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld have said that this war may last 50 years, certainly enough to get Mr. Bush elected to a second term and to see another hard-nosed reactionary person elected president on this fear factor, it becomes harder for people to understand how the world works. Now, I myself, of course, think that people who do terrorist acts, anybody who planned and was involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center, should be brought to justice, should be tried, should be given whatever sentence comes out of that, which I would hope it would be very harsh, because the murder of innocent people is terrible. But what we've done is very different. We've now killed more people in Afghanistan than died in the World Trade Center. Now, it's hard to prove that because the U.S. government will not allow the information, will not let independent sources go in and verify. The Department of Defense bought the privately owned satellite system, which would allow us to watch where the American bombing went. And they did bought all the rights to it so that the television stations couldn't. We have no way of knowing, and so we're told the war went well, there were no casualties and so on, except that we tend to shoot our own helicopters down and stuff like that. But we don't talk about what's happened to Afghans, and now they're talking about taking on other countries, which will mean more people died. Now, I don't think anybody, this so-called axis of terror, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea thrown in to say we're not just concerned with Muslims, that we, you know, we're North Korea is responsible somehow for the World Trade Center too, is in a sense laughable, but it means they can basically attack any government now as harboring terrorists, and this is a very scary situation. So that one of the things I think is very important for progressive people to be thinking about at this point, there is not a separation between being for global social justice. I myself think accepting the term anti-globalization movement is wrong. Most people I know are not against globalization, they're for international solidarity. They want a different type of globalization, one that respects people and cultures and wants to see that people, just because they're born in other countries and in terrible conditions, they should have the same life chances as we have. We were lucky to be born in a better situation, okay, but it's nothing we did. And similarly, it's nothing that some poor kid that's born in Iraq who's being killed and starved by this blockade that the United States has put supposedly to get Saddam Hussein, but has killed a million Iraqi people, half of them under the age of five. These are terrible terrorist acts the United States is engaged in, and they are not targeted to particular people who followed policies that have hurt us or other people, but they're indiscriminate in killing so many people in the same way that the World Trade Center bombing was. Only it's slower, it's not as dramatic, but it kills many more people. So to be anti-war and to think about the foreign policy of the United States is an important part of being for global social justice. And we will not be able to have the conversation about the IMF and the World Bank and the World Economic Forum and so on. This conversation is much harder until we connect it to the terrorist policies of the United States, the foreign policies, and what we are doing when we declare war on terrorists, what we're doing domestically in shredding the Constitution. And, you know, I was on a panel yesterday with a professor from Columbia who is of Iranian background, and he has a nicely trimmed beard, a brilliant intellectual. And he was coming back from a conference in Italy, and he was on the plane, and he gets up to use the bathroom, and he said 50 pair of eyes went to him thinking, my God, we're dead, he's a terrorist. As a poor guy, he's an American, he's lived here all his life, and he sat down. He really had to go to the bathroom, but he knew what they were going through. And, of course, just checking in through the airports for so many Americans now is this hideous business. If you're not picked up and arrested, as thousands of Americans have, just because they look the wrong way. All of these things are connected, and so that when we fight for the rights of immigrants and other Americans who fit profiles of these racial profiling sorts of things, and when we watch the president declare war on the rest of the world if it doesn't do exactly what we say, these are all issues that tie together. And I think that one of the things that is developing in this period is the United States is polarizing very extremely, and that a very large number of people are coming to think I'm talking about. But other people are hunkering down and say, nuke them, kill them, you know, this kind of cowboy image that George Bush wanted dead or alive kind of thing. And so we're in a very difficult position where there has to be lots of mass work and not a stepping back saying, you know, Americans were killed, therefore we can't have democracy anymore. Americans were killed, we can't talk about why people hate us around the world. Americans are killed, we can't talk about the bad things the American government does. I think that's wrong. This is a time we must do it. This is what democracy means, and this is the way you change the world, because another world, as they say, is possible.
You're listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report, with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And we're talking with Bill Tabb, author of the new book, The Amoral Elephant, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century.
You know, Bill, regulatory frameworks such as the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, NAFTA, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act are really, many of us believe, there to provide shifts in freedom of opportunity for capital at the expense of social needs. The International Monetary Fund, indeed the World Economic Forum, have couched themselves in these general terms NAFTA has of good for the developing nations. But what do they really accomplish in terms of that shift of capital and that expansion of opportunity for capital, again, at the expense, clearly, or maybe it's not so clearly for people, at the expense of social needs and distribution of wealth for developing nations, for the poor around the world?
Okay, well, that's, of course, what my book, The Amoral Elephant, is about. I talk about the Multinational Agreement on Investment and NAFTA and the Africa Growth Act and all the rest of that stuff. But to try and, you know, scrunch it down, to talk about it, what each of these things, the free trade area of the Americas, what they're all trying to do is say individual nations can't make their own rules anymore. There's going to be a set of rules which prevents any nation from breaking the rules set up by these global, I call them global state economic governance institutions, which is a bit long, but it's a global government that's coming into being. But it's not a democratic government in the sense that you don't get to vote for it. The thing about your national government is you may not like the people who control your country, and you may know, of course, that money buys elections and all the rest of it, but in theory, it would be possible for progressive movements to win elections. The deck is stacked against it. It's inconceivable, really, the difficulty of that for Jesse Jackson's campaign or Ralph Nader or some other person who we might want in preference to the kind of people we get, because money and the media dominate so much. But it's theoretically possible. At the global level, this government is more invisible. You don't get to vote for the IMF, and at the IMF, it's not one country, one vote, as it is in the United Nations. You know, the UN General Assembly, big countries, small countries, everybody can speak, everybody gets a vote. There is the Security Council, which is the way the great powers prevent everybody else from doing anything we don't like, because the U.S. can use its veto. But at least it's all there, it's out in the open, you know what's going on. With something like the IMF, voting is weighted, and when the IMF was set up in 1944 at Bretton Woods at the end of the war, the United States set it up in such a way that only one country was allocated enough votes, because voting is proportional to how much money you pledge to the IMF, your quota, and the one country that has veto power all by itself is the United States. So basically the whole world could vote one way and we could vote the other and we'd win. So these are not democratic institutions in that sense, nor are they democratic institutions in the sense that ordinary citizens in the around the world have any input into what the IMF does. So that the World Trade Organization, the people who go to these things are the secretaries of the Treasury, the people who represent big business. And they work with the corporations. That before these meetings, there are meetings in the United States of what's called the Business Roundtable, which is the chief executives of the largest U.S. corporations. They will get together, set out policy, and then they will meet with the American U.S. Trade Representative, and there will be committees on all the items that are going to be taken up. The corporations will work out exactly what they want the United States to do, and then the United States goes and imposes it on the rest of the world at these meetings. So the corporations basically dominate the policy here. One of the reasons the World Economic Forum was targeted is this is where the leaders from, we say around the world, but that's not quite true. The World Economic Forum is overwhelmingly people from the United States and Western Europe. They're overwhelmingly white. There's very little color at the World Economic Forum. There are very few women. The board of the World Economic Forum appointed a woman, I guess, last year. Up to that, it was totally male. So the elites use these organizations. There's a dialogue group between the American corporations and the European corporations, the transatlantic business dialogue. And what they do is they take the American corporate roundtable group and the European counterpart group, and they meet, and the European and American top capitalists decide on policies. They then meet with the representatives of their governments, and then when they go to the World Trade Organization, they've been given their marching orders. So while the protesters are protesting the World Trade Organization or the IMF, as of course they should, behind that are the most powerful governments in the world, and behind what they do are policies which they didn't in fact choose themselves, but were chosen for them by these large, the hugest banks, transnational corporations, who meet and have planning sessions and so on, so that by the time the World Trade Organization meets, the policies are already set, and it's a question of can they muscle the rest of the countries forcing them to accept what these corporations want. So how do you deal with it? How do you change it? For one thing, a wonderful thing, was BAI is now back to talking about real things in a progressive and good way. that we have to use the independent media we have. The fact that so many students are involved in this, it is in fact a new upsurge on the campuses like the 60s, and that may signal, if we can deal with this question of terrorism and war in a sensible way, a very substantial change in policy that's possible, whether it comes about or whether the Bush people and the media, and I should say that the media, I don't want to call them cowards, but they have become the official mouthpiece of Washington, where Dan Rather says, I will go where my president tells me to go, I will do what my president tells me to do, and of course Fox beating the drums for war, and the newspapers having basically printing press releases from Donald Rumsfeld and so on. The movement has got to show not just that another world is possible, but it has to show how this world operates and how power is exercised. That's the only way a movement can be built.
In terms of strategy, I mean, I think the AFL-CIO is really focusing on specific trade agreements, and of course fast-tracked, and to a large extent the movement focuses upon debt forgiveness and Jubilee 2000. What do you hang your hat on this in terms of strategy? Forgiveness of the third world debt.
Debt cancellation is really what you want to talk about. The so-called third world debt that the poor countries of the world, many of them are not democratic countries. Many of them are run by military strongmen, presidents like Mugabe, who won't allow free elections. And what these leaders do is they borrow a great deal of money, some of which finds its way into their Swiss bank accounts. A country like the Philippines, where the former president, the next government usually goes after them trying to get back some of the many millions or billions of dollars they've got in Swiss banks. Nigeria. There's so many of these countries which are fundamentally corrupt. And I should add quickly that they're corrupt because when the former colonial rulers left these countries, they left in place ruling elites and sometimes individual military strongmen trained typically in the United States in anti kind of techniques to maintain power in your country and put down free trade unions and school teachers and how to assassinate people and so on. And so that Western capital is totally, totally involved in the corruption of these governments to keep the materials, raw materials and so on flowing from these people and the wealth coming out of Africa and Latin America into the transnationals. So the debt was created through this corrupt policy of the banks lending money to people they knew to be dishonest for purposes, most of which they knew to be totally not in the interest of the people of their countries, and knowing that they could use the power of the U.S. government and the IMF to get their money back. So the debt has in effect been paid in most countries. It's been paid and repaid and repaid many, many times. Because what the countries are doing is, it's like being in debt to the company store, or many people who have credit cards where they're paying 20% interest. They never pay off the credit card. They just pay interest on the 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 money they owe. So for these countries, they've already transferred much more than they borrowed in terms of interest payments over many years now, and there is no way they're going to get out of debt. They're spending 40, 50, 60% of all of their earnings just to pay interest on, in effect, their credit card. Only the people of these countries didn't borrow the money. They didn't benefit. They didn't ask for the money. It was these corrupt elites that did. So it's not a question of debt forgiveness. It's a question of debt cancellation and preventing the banks from in effect, doing this kind of stuff and impoverishing countries around the world. So where I stand on that is fairly simple. The debt should be canceled, and banks should not be making loans for weapon purchases, not be making loans to corrupt local regimes, and the United States should stop supporting those governments so that there's some hope for democracy and governments that represent their people, because then if they borrowed and borrowed responsibly, used the money to build up their economies so that the money would be invested in things that would help pay off the debt. If the money is not borrowed in order to invest in productive activities, that almost guarantees a debt crisis. Because if the money is borrowed and it's used, it goes out to Swiss bank accounts, or it's used to import Mercedes-Benz and luxury goods for the elites, how is it going to be paid back? It's got to be paid back in dollars, which means the country must export more and import less of the things ordinary people need. So the structure is a very oppressive structure. And so not only should there be debt cancellation, but the support of these governments and the anti-democratic ways that the United States and their rulers run those countries has to stop. So the final thing on that, many Americans think that the United States gives a great deal of foreign aid, that we are very generous and we give money to these countries. Actually, we give less money in foreign aid than any other advanced country in the world. We give 0.1% of our gross domestic product. Not 1%, but 0.1%. This is about $32 for every American goes in foreign aid. Most of that foreign aid goes to Israel and Egypt. Very little of it goes, because of domestic and international politics. Most of the rest goes to regimes that we support in other parts of the world. And the poorest countries get nothing. They get hardly any foreign aid from the United States. We don't give anything. And the more progressive countries, the Swedens, the Denmarks, they give 7-8 times what we do. The amount of foreign aid the United States gives has not gone up in the last 10 years. It stayed the same, and it's very minimal. So in all of these ways, our country is not having a very good role in the world.
In the recent protests on the World Economic Forum around there, a woman, very well-dressed, good-natured woman, stopped me on the street as I was in proximity to her and said, "What do they want?" And I very succinctly, still focused on the demonstration, try to give some voice to what this large number of predominantly young people wanted, egalitarianism, a sense of humanity. And I thought I'd try to put a human face on some of the concerns. And I have recently seen Life and Death, Stephanie Black's wonderful film on Jamaica and these very issues. And I said, "Well, you know, how do you feel about local dairy farmers in Jamaica dumping their milk because they can't sell it because we are importing, for example, powdered milk, which has almost no value at half the cost, and therefore we are really destroying the economic balance and ability of the dairy farmers to put out their goods in Jamaica, etc. That free trade, you can't compete with these large nations." And she said, "Well, yeah, however, isn't each nation supposed to do what they do, which is profit their own citizens, and there's a kind of survival of the fittest, and that's what makes America great. That's the opportunity and competitiveness in the market. We've shown how great we are, and that's why we dominate."
But we don't. The American dairy farmers get huge subsidies from the government. That the price of milk in this country would be much lower than it is if the United States was not subsidizing dairy. When we export rice and we tell the Haitian they must import American rice because that's free trade, our rice producers are very heavily subsidized, and yet we tell the Haitians they can't subsidize their rice producers, they can't protect their rice producers, or in your case, Jamaica and dairy. So that we have a system in which the United States has very high tariffs against those products produced in the developing countries which compete with our products. That in manufacturing, the things that the poor countries can do where they have competitive advantage, and here I'm just talking about capitalist rules, I'm not talking about anything beyond what this lady was talking about with you, that in a competitive world, we would import textiles and clothing and shoes from labor-intensive products from poorer countries because that's what they can produce more cheaply than we can. But those are the products where the tariffs, the tariff is a tax on imports, the tariffs on imports are very, very high on products coming from the third world. The same thing is true of agricultural products. Many third world countries have an advantage over the United States and Europe in producing food and other agricultural products. But those are the areas where the Europeans and the Americans have the highest tariffs. And then if a country, Mozambique or somebody who produces nuts tried to export peanut butter instead, there would be high tariffs. That is, they'll allow in the things we can't produce with low tariff, but if the country, Brazil, tries to make freeze-dried coffee or something, as soon as they start moving up the value-added chain, so not only would they give us the raw materials at low prices, but they would compete with Maxwell House or somebody, they face high tariffs. So it is not true, in fact, that we practice free trade. The whole business, the World Trade Organization, what do we think is important? We think intellectual property must be protected to keep the East Asians from copying computer chips or something like that. But, of course, that's how the United States got to be industrialized. We copied textile machines from the British. And the way every country has developed is it is drawn on the science, the knowledge that's developed in more advanced countries to have their economy grow. So we've used the World Trade Organization to prevent other countries from developing. We've used our own tariff policies to prevent them from selling here. And then we say we're for free trade. So it's in fact not true, even on the terms that the lady was raising it, let alone moving beyond that to the kind of social justice issues you were raising with her.
To what extent in the third world, though, I mean, can they develop even with free trade, or is it necessary to close off the markets from developed countries and protect their industry?
Well, here there's disagreement, and my own feeling is that it is not a good idea to close yourself off totally to the rest of the world. Countries like North Korea or Myanmar, the Burma, which the generals who control the country and have, basically they've enslaved their people, forcing them into forced labor to work for the military, as the International Labor Organization has said over and over, that countries that isolate themselves from the rest of the world tend to turn to fairly repressive forms, or even if they're not repressive, it is very difficult because you want to be able to import technologies that will help you develop. So the real question for me is not closing yourself off from the world, but being able to establish the terms on which you interact with the rest of the world. China has done this really quite brilliantly. You know, I think of them as market Leninists. They're market Leninists because, as Leninists, they control the terms on which foreign corporations can come into China. That if you want to set up a plant, you have to do it under terms the Chinese government wants you to. And the Chinese say, you don't have to come invest here, but if you do, you have to bring latest technology, you have to export a certain part of your output so that we get foreign exchange earnings so we can buy other things. Which is not to set China up as a model. There are very severe problems with how they treat their people and the way they industrialize and all the rest of that. But countries should have a right to establish the terms on which foreign corporations do business in their country. And they should be able to protect their economy, to protect their food self-sufficiency, to protect their banking system. And so all of the neoliberal policies are in place to interfere with the rights of people in other countries and their governments to set the terms on which they deal with the more powerful transnational corporations and international banks. So we need what a just world would involve, and here I'm just talking about a just capitalist world, not changing the system. But if you're talking about capitalism as a fair competitive system, then societies have a right to set the terms on which they interact with the rest of the world. Nobody should be forced to give up its wealth, give up its resources, exploit its people just because the transnational corporations call that free trade.
I want to go back to my woman on the street corner who also told me that why shouldn't Bill Gates, who is brilliant, reap the benefit of his brilliance by the concentration of tremendous wealth, which he freely circulates. And indeed, he gave a lecture at the World Economic Forum on dealing with the pan-epidemic of AIDS in Africa, the benevolence of capital. What does, though, what do you begin to say to this woman, let's take a more opportunistic view, about, again, globalization and the assault, as you have it in one of your book chapters, on the U.S. population, that her image is very much a fraud?
Well, let's look at Bill Gates, or let's look at Thomas Alva Edison. When Edison captured electricity, or when Graham Bell developed the first telephone, if these people were allowed to monopolize for the total future of the world how electricity would be used, and that you could only have electric lights if Edison Company allowed you to have electric lights, and you had to pay whatever the Edison Company demanded for the right to have electricity in your house, they would in fact be able to take the wealth that was created by all the working people. And I don't know if you've seen the Broadway musical Urinetown. Urinetown is a Broadway musical in which, well, maybe that's the wrong way to go, but let's stick with electricity because it's actually a very interesting musical. They took the worst possible title they could and the most implausible theme they could and actually made a pretty good musical out of it.
It's not about the privatization of water, is it?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. That's exactly, and the pissoirs of the city. But let's take electricity, or let's take the telephone. Unless they're in capitalism, unless there's competition, the monopolist can charge you whatever they want. And what Bill Gates did with the Windows operating system was set up anyone who wants to run a computer, when he had the monopoly before there were other operating systems available, he was able to tell software programmers, if you want to write it for the Windows system, this is how you have to do it. And he could prevent other people from innovating and creating better ways of running the computer. So that our whole, and now they want to control the internet. Just as AOL Time Warner is trying to bring together media and internet access, what they're trying to do is enclose what should be commonly available to everybody, and in that to get the monopoly power to extract the rents, to collect on the laborers, because people will have to pay them. And what capitalism does is not really about competition. Bill Gates certainly is not about competition. He's about preventing competition. He's about driving out, with the billions of dollars he has, driving out or buying out competitors so that he controls the new technologies. And while it's true that the stuff Microsoft brought to market was very good, very important, very helpful, once a company does that, because they want to make as much money as they can, they then try and prevent others from doing that. And so they stifle competition instead of encouraging competition. And that's why there was the case against Microsoft. It wasn't saying that Windows wasn't a good idea, but it's saying that by controlling that, he has his hands around the neck and can throttle the whole internet and the whole computerization. So I think she doesn't quite have that right. Now, as to his charity work, did not begin until the case against him by the United States government. Until he was accused of being a monopolist, and until people could clearly see what he was about, he didn't give a penny to charity. He was one of the most selfish and tight-fisted individuals there was. He hired the consultants, and they explained to him that it's one thing to be the richest man in the world, but if you're seen as grasping, selfish, power-hungry, ruthless, cutthroat in your dealings and business, then America will rise against you, the world will rise against you, and you're going to lose it all. So he became this benevolent guy. But it's very recent, and I think you should bear that in mind.
Since you brought it up, let's talk about privatization. I mean, on one front in South Africa, there's been a lot of resistance by trade unions and others to pressures to privatize a number of different industries there. What role does privatization of state enterprises play in all of this in the third world?
Probably the easiest place to see it, well, pick your target. The things that are privatized are almost always monopoly functions that the government has handled, like water delivery, like electricity, like the telephone company. In many countries, the electrical system is owned by the government, or water is distributed by the government, or the post office is owned by the government. And often these services are inefficient. They're inefficient because the government tries to keep the price of postage low so that people can send letters. It tries to keep the price of the bus. The bus lines are often owned by the government. Because if you charge the full cost of the bus ride to the worker, the employers would have to pay much higher wages. And at the existing wages, people couldn't afford to take the bus to work and back each day and have enough left over to eat. And so in Mexico or Argentina or someplace, the basic necessities of life are run by the government and prices kept artificially low so that ordinary people can survive. When privatization comes in, the service generally improves. Not always, but it generally improves because a private company comes in and says, we're tripling the price and we're going to use the part of that money to improve the quality of the services. So the telephone service gets better. It's easier to get a telephone. You don't have to wait as long. However, it costs you three times as much. So people who used to be able to afford telephones can't anymore. Or electricity is privatized and the price jumps, but there are fewer brownouts because the company buys generators. But many people don't have access to electricity anymore. So what you're doing is you're substituting a public monopoly and you're getting a private monopoly. The private monopoly can charge whatever it wants. And since it's a service people desperately need, the telephone, electricity, water, these are bus rides to work. These are things people have to or badly need to have. And so they pay. And that leaves everybody with far less money to buy food and clothing and the other things they need, because the privatized monopoly has now raised the price so much. Rich people look at it differently. For a rich person, who the higher price is no big deal, it's a better thing, like garbage pickup. In a lot of third world countries, the city garbage pickup is not the most dependable. Well, when you privatize that, the rich people buy really good garbage collection, and poor people, the poor neighborhoods, the garbage just sits there because people are don't have the money to pay to have it carted away for them. So what privatization does is it increases the inequalities of services between rich and poor. And it takes out of the public realm, out of the area where everybody is entitled to education. Private education does the same thing. The rich send their kids to private school, and they want to privatize all of education. Because then, since they send their kids to private school anyway, if all education is privatized, then they don't have to pay taxes to educate the poor. So they're therefore privatizing absolutely everything, because from their point of view, services will get better and it'll cost them less money. But for everybody else, they'll lose those services because they can't afford to buy it on a private market. That's what government's for. Government's to make the society more equal, make opportunity equal to kids growing up in poor families should at least be able to ride the bus to school and get water and electricity and so on. So I think that's how you want to look at the worst aspects of what privatization can do. Well, one other worst aspect is the public companies are almost always sold to cronies of the government. They're either sold to foreign investors who bribe the government, or they're sold to the local elites who get them at very low prices and then pay off the government. So the corruption around privatization in most parts of the world is just very extreme.
Bill, the concern of Dennis Brutus, who is for listeners who may not know, a former political prisoner in South Africa, brilliant poet, now lectures at a university in this country. who has become a rather aggressive critic of the policies of Thabo Mbeki and the South African government that he fought long and hard to install in power. How is it possible, given the alignment of world forces, or the fact that there is no longer a non-aligned governments of the world and no polarity towards the hegemony of U.S. capital, to begin within the limits of the possible to alter the situation for the development of the beleaguered nations throughout this globe? How do you begin the process?
Let me deal with this question, but let me also say for people listening, we're recording this on Sunday morning, and you're hearing it at a different time. And at my house, there are about a dozen young people who came in for the World Economic Forum protest who are beginning to wake up. And it's rather late in the morning, but they're beginning to wake up, and I've got to go take care of breakfast and sort of getting everything organized to get them fed so they can get out on the...
We'll make this the last question for you. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah. South Africa is a situation of very intense class conflict within the black population. That what the white capitalist class of South Africa and transnational capital have done is they have bought, the as best they can, the educated leadership of the black community. People who were freedom fighters through the anti-apartheid struggle, who have sacrificed much, have gone to jail, have been offered huge amounts of money to come work for foreign corporations or for white-owned South African corporations. And it is very difficult for the government to keep the kind of technical, educated, political leadership it needs to have an independent South Africa. Because it's under apartheid, very few blacks were given the opportunity to become educated. And so many of the people who were very active in the fight against apartheid have now been co-opted, if you will, and it's easy to understand why, because the government can't pay you much, the trade union movement can't pay you much, the mass organizations. And now, for the first time, you have the opportunity to live a very comfortable life, and many people have done that. So the struggle in South Africa is a very complex one, because the government, Mbeki's government itself, includes as its economics minister and in some important positions people who have accepted the neoliberal line and who are, in effect, telling the masses of black people who've had nothing all their lives that it's just going to be a long time, that we have to sacrifice now to give incentives to corporations and so on. And it's a balance. It's not one or the other, that under the system we live under, they have to deal with the corporations. But they're giving away a great deal that they don't have to give away. And so that the more principled, militant people in the government and in COSATU, the labor federation, are trying to help the government see that they've got to work for the people and at the same time deal with the corporations in a way that's more principled. And that is a struggle that will go on within South Africa.
Well, we've been speaking with William Tabb, the amoral elephant, not himself, but the book, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century. And thank you for being so gracious and spending so much time with us, particularly with the raucous upstarts who are commanding and demanding breakfast downstairs.
No, they're wonderful kids, and I'm happy to do it. Thanks, Ken.
And they're also demanding another
pleasure.
World.
We'll talk
thank
again,
you very
Bill.
Much.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We've been talking with William Tabb, author of The Amoral Elephant, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century. We're broadcast on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM in the New York area, on Mondays from 2 to 3 p.m., and on Radio in Exile, www.wbix.org, on Tuesdays from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our website is www.buildingbridgesradio.org. You can contact us at knash@igc.org. For Building Bridges, this is Ken Nash in Solidarity.